You might have noticed that Congress is making news lately without even being in session. Congress members took off for their holiday recess with very few bills passed in 2013, one of the least productive years of Congress ever. And one of the things Congress did not do, as it has in previous years, is extend long-term benefits for unemployed people. So between Christmas and New Year's, the payments ended for more than a million people. This is the same Congress that shows resistance to passing an increase in the minimum wage. Today's guest is well-versed in both issues. Judy Conte is with the National Employment Law Project, which I'll call NELP for short, and is the federal advocacy coordinator there. Judy, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi there. Pleasure to be with you. Thanks for inviting me.
So do you call it NELP there, too?
We do.
Okay. So what is NELP? Give us a little background sketch on what it is you do.
Sure. NELP is a nonprofit organization. We'll be celebrating our 45th anniversary this year. We are advocates for low-wage and unemployed workers, and we have a number of areas of concentration, but basically what we do is try to help make sure that people get and keep good jobs.
And how's the progress been in recent years?
You know, it's been tough the last few years. I joke with people, and I don't mean to sound insensitive by saying this, but as we specialize a lot in issues of unemployment insurance and trying to return the long-term unemployed back to work, and I've sort of in gallows humor joked about it being one of the few growth industries in the country, but it's been tough. You know, workers have seen wages stagnate at the same time that corporate profits have not only fully recovered from the recession but are booming. The plight of the long-term unemployed is quite desperate. So it's been tough going, but at the same time we've seen some really hopeful signs, mostly out of various states, in terms of things states are doing to try to raise their own minimum wages, to engage in some job creation or creative programs to get people back to work, and things they've done to remove unreasonable barriers that people face in getting jobs, like, you know, people with criminal records that are in far too many places barred from jobs that they very reasonably could hold once they've been rehabilitated and paid the price for their crime. And we're seeing some good progress in those areas. So we're hopeful that we're going to be turning the corner and that people across the country and their political officials are understanding that the current disregard we have for workers and the inequity that we see in wages and benefits and the way that people treat it is just no way to build an economy that works for everyone.
Let's come back to the stagnation issue you raised a moment ago, because this is one that's been discussed a lot, particularly by some of the economic columnists like Paul Krugman. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there's certainly evidence at the state level as well. Oregon had indicated in a recent report that there's growth at the upper end of the income scale and growth at the lower end of the income scale, but not much happening in the middle. Is that a national picture as well?
It really is. There's a little bit more growth in the bottom of the income scale in Oregon than I think is representative nationally, because you have one of the highest minimum wages in the country, because Oregon indexes it, so it goes up every year on January 1st. So you're one of the states that is doing, you know, better things for its low-wage workers as compared with a lot of other places in the country. But, it's true. We just see the middle class being squeezed more and more. And trying to do more with less. And it's our country has been at its healthiest, and our economy has thrived the most when the middle class thrives. And that means there are as few people as possible living in poverty. We are a consumer-driven nation, and that is the way our economy functions best. So when people have money in their pockets to spend on food and gasoline and clothing and their bills, those are the ways that our economy thrives.
Is part of the issue for the middle class that some of the institutions that have been formed over the years to protect the needs or the wishes of the middle class just not there in as great a presence anymore, labor unions specifically?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, when our middle class has been strongest, it has also been when union density is strongest. And that is no coincidence. And anybody who tries to tell you otherwise is just—
You anticipated the question then, yes.
Yeah, it's just, you know, flat out a lie. So, when labor unions thrive, and in communities where we see active labor union presence, there are, you know, across the whole community, there are higher wages and better benefits, even for those who aren't unionized. So as the labor union movement and its density has declined, our middle class has declined right along with it.
All right. So, Judy, let's talk about the issue with the long-term unemployment payments, because anybody who has not necessarily received them might not be entirely clear about what's going on. But generally, you're guaranteed X number of weeks of unemployment insurance payments, but there have been extensions through the course of the recession?
Correct. Generally, and this is the case in Oregon, states pay 26 weeks of unemployment benefits, 6 months after you've lost a job through no fault of your own. And that is money that is there to, you know, help you remain economically stable while you're looking for a new job. During that time, people who are receiving them are expected to continue a zealous search for work and accept suitable work when offered to them. And they have to continually certify that in order to stay eligible. And generally, it is only the state benefits that are available to workers. However, in periods of recession, the federal government, through Congress, has always authorized additional levels of benefits for the people who are long-term unemployed, those who are unemployed for over 6 months. And we have erected four different tiers of benefits right now. And people in all states get an additional 14 weeks, up through an additional 47 weeks in the states that are hardest hit by unemployment.
All right. And California and Oregon come onto that list at all?
They do. They get an additional 37 weeks of unemployment benefits.
All right. So what's the maximum that anybody could have gotten up through December 28th?
73 weeks, but there's very few states that are eligible for that. It's only Illinois and Nevada. I believe Rhode Island and Michigan were unfortunately again able to receive those level of benefits through beginning in December. But the maximum that most states are receiving is 63, and many are receiving far fewer than that.
All right. Unemployment benefits and the minimum wage on the table with Judy Conte from the National Employment Law Project. We'll come back and talk more with her and take your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our topic today is worker benefits, and it takes a couple of different directions here. We're talking not only about long-term unemployment benefits that Congress did not extend at the end of the year. We're also talking about the prospects for rises in the minimum wage at the federal level. It is above the federal level in both of our states. You can join us as we discuss this with Judy Conte, who is with the National Employment Law Project as the Federal Advocacy Coordinator. Our phone number is on the exchange, 800-838-3760. That's anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. So we're just talking about it's a mix of states. I mean, the hardest hit states are getting up to 73 weeks, or had gotten up to 73 weeks of unemployment benefits. So I want to talk just about the mechanism for a moment here, though, mm-hmm. because nobody saw any differences in the checks, right? It was simply just a matter of the feds were funneling money to the states to continue the checks to the
exactly.
people. Yeah. Okay. All right. So that takes care of the mechanism. But
right.
So what was it that Congress? I mean, was there even a bill on the table as the Christmas break came upon the Congress?
Yes, there was. Representative Sandy Levin from Michigan in the House and Senator Jack Reed from Rhode Island in the Senate each introduced bills that would reauthorize the Federal Emergency Unemployment Compensation Program through the end of 2014. Keep the program up and running in its current state. A very, you know, simple, straightforward bill.
All right, so no particular changes at all. It's still up to 73 weeks for some states.
Correct. For states that had unemployment of over 9%, they could get up to 73 weeks. States over 7% would get 63 weeks, and you know, it would go down a little bit more with each. As your state does better, you get less benefits, which makes perfect sense, of course.
So does the entire extension program then just get wiped out with the failure to extend that bill? Is everybody back to 26 weeks now?
It is. They're back to a maximum of 26 weeks. There are actually a few states who have cut back below 26 weeks, Oregon not being one of them. Oregon actually has one of the best unemployment insurance programs in the entire country, the most generous and also one of the best run programs. So I want to make sure your listeners know that. But right now, unless we can get this program up and running again and retroactively authorized, all that workers have now are their state benefits. And the problem with that is, although we see our unemployment rate coming down as a general rule, The measures of long-term unemployment, those people who have been out of a job for over 6 months, really aren't improving at all. A year ago, about the average duration of unemployment was 38 weeks. Now it's about 37 weeks. So while we've seen almost an entire point reduction in unemployment overall, we're not really seeing much of an improvement in the duration of long-term unemployment. We're also seeing pretty much the same percentage, you know, high, about 37% of unemployed workers are the long-term unemployed. And what it tells us is that fewer people are losing jobs, and those who are generally getting jobs more quickly than they were during the height of the recession and the beginning of the recovery. But once you pass that six-month point, it becomes sort of almost exponentially more difficult to find a job. And I hate to almost say that out loud and discourage your listeners who have been out of work for over 6 months, because people certainly shouldn't give up. There are success stories all over the country. But it is very difficult to find a job the longer that you are out of work for any number of reasons, not the least of which is we know that employers actively discriminate against the long-term unemployed and make all sorts of assumptions about either why they're unemployed for that long or about their skills atrophying, and are reluctant to give them a fair shot in the interviewing process. So it's a scary situation out there.
I've heard that one about the skills atrophying. So are you saying that potential employers will look and see, oh, you last worked, more than 6 months ago?
Right. And, you know, they'll make assumptions about skills atrophying, even in industries and in practices and in trades where skills don't atrophy. I mean, if you're in retail, if, you know, you're in service, like, those aren't skills that atrophy. Your people skills are your people skills. Even people that work more in, you know, technological fields, though, and, you know, I have many friends that do, and I've asked them about this. I'm like, you know, what about this myth that your skills are going to atrophy? And they all tell me that, you know, people who are technologically inclined are people that know how to figure out how to use new technology and figure out how to use it fairly quickly. It's not that they're constantly taking training courses on new software or new programs so that they can keep abreast of things. They find the new stuff, they play around with it and figure out how it works, and then they integrate it into their work. And that's something that people can do. If you have that aptitude, you're going to be able to do that whether you've been out of work for a little while or not. The thing is that employers are increasingly not even giving people a chance to demonstrate that they could do that. They're just making these assumptions or assuming, I think for some complex psychological reasons, quite frankly, that, well, if you've been unemployed that long, there must be a good reason for it, you know, which I think just betrays a complete lack of understanding about what our current economy is really like.
So, Judy, can we assume that this is hitting people who are older a little harder?
It is. All of the statistics show us that older workers, and by that I mean people over the age of 50, are less likely to lose their jobs. But once they do, they are much more likely to become the long-term unemployed. And the answer for that is, or the reason for that is fairly obvious, that it's, it's age discrimination. Increasingly, as people have to apply for jobs online, there are all sorts of information they have to key in about, you know, graduation dates, your employment history, all of these things that betray what someone's age is. And people shy away from older workers because they may cost more, because they have, you know, ageist assumptions about them. Maybe especially for people who are over the age of 60 and want to keep working, maybe people will assume that they're only going to be there for a couple of years without making that individual inquiry as to whether or not this is a person that still has a long career left in them. So there's all sorts of reasons for it, but when you see somebody over the age of 50 has lost their job, it's cause for additional worry, because that is somebody that's really likely to have a much harder time getting back into the workforce.
We have an email here from Tony in Medford, which makes the case against extending unemployment benefits. He says that any economic stimulus from unemployment insurance benefits will be counteracted by the economic depressing effects of the higher taxes ultimately required to pay for them. I'm going to have to make this a little shorter here. He says benefits increase unemployment because they reduce the incentive for people to find work. Higher unemployment insurance benefits delay the need for people to make difficult choices about their careers, such as switching industries, taking lower pay, or moving to a different city. It's a truism that when the government subsidizes something, we get more of it. I'm going to skip ahead here. Tony writes, Our unemployment insurance system also suppresses personal savings because people expect the government to care for them when they are unemployed. So why bother to worry about future rainy days? That is harmful because personal savings are a key source of economic growth. Savings get channeled into capital investment, which ultimately raises productivity and wages. Tony concludes, Milton Friedman got it right. There really is no free lunch, particularly in subsidy programs. So there's the case against extending unemployment insurance benefits. What's your read on those arguments? I'm sure you've heard them before.
I have, and I could honestly spend the rest of your show and then some refuting it point by point. I'll make a couple of points, though. First of all, unemployment insurance benefits usually only replace anywhere from 30 to 50% of the wages that you were previously making, and they are capped as well. So high-income earners don't even get close to 30% of their wages replaced. So it's no free ride. It's no free lunch, as Tony would like to say. It's, you know, it's a sort of a subsistence-level subsidy at best, still subject to income tax, I might add, as well. So nobody's sitting home eating bonbons, enjoying being unemployed and living the high life on those benefits. You know, the other thing, as I stated, is that people have to be looking for work and accepting suitable work and certifying that they're doing so in order to keep getting those benefits. So there's a built-in check in the system to make sure that people aren't gaming the system that way. You know, we can look to North Carolina, which as of July 1st stopped receiving these extended benefits because it reduced its state benefits so much that it violated something called the non-reduction rule. You know, the states have to agree basically not to reduce their unemployment benefits while they're receiving EUC. And North Carolina decided that it was going to reduce its benefits regardless and lost the EUC benefits. Since that time, their unemployment rate has dropped fairly precipitously, but 95% of the improvement is because people are leaving the workforce. It's not because they are finding jobs. You know, it's all well and good to put forth this theory that if we suddenly remove benefits, people will just settle for what's out there and take the job. But the fact of the matter is that in our current economy, there is only one open job for every three unemployed workers in this country, which means that if we filled every open job with unemployed workers only, there would still be about 8 million people that we couldn't employ. So it's a very convenient scapegoat, and it serves a political end to rail against unemployment benefits as incenting people to stay out of work. But it's just really not true. They're not generous benefits. They are subject to people zealously looking for new work. And our economy just isn't producing enough jobs for people to be employed. What we will see happen is, if this program is allowed to remain unauthorized, is we may well see an improvement in the unemployment rate, but it's going to be largely and overwhelmingly because people will give up and stop looking. And that's the worst thing, getting sort of to the last point that Tony made about people saving money and making capital investments, and that's how we grow jobs. That's not how this economy grows jobs anymore. We are a consumer-driven economy. People have to spend money out in the local mom-and-pops, the big box stores, the supermarkets. You know, we need to spend money in order to generate the kind of jobs that are growing in our economy. And the only way that we do that is when people have money to spend. So if we all of a sudden see people drop out of the workforce altogether, we're going to see less consumer demand and a contraction of employment. We're also simultaneously going to see people going on to more types of public benefits in order to make ends meet. So we could save money by not spending it on unemployment, but we're going to pay it somewhere else. I would just note in summary for your listeners who are among the long-term unemployed, on the state of Oregon's unemployment insurance website, they do have a list of resources for people who can't make ends meet, even on their unemployment benefits, in terms of food and medical care and housing and all the sorts of public benefits that are available. And it's a great resource, and people should look to it.
Judy Conte is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She's with the National Employment Law Project as federal advocacy coordinator. We're talking about unemployment insurance and the minimum wage, both issues before Congress, whether it chooses to act upon them or not. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 or 541-552-6782 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. I want to come back to a term you used in the middle of that discussion about having to look for work and accept suitable work. Is that where the real wiggle room is, the suitable part? Because it seems like the implication from the people who don't want to extend benefits is that people apply for jobs, don't really mean to get them, and refuse them.
That is not what's happening. Now, first of all, if you're out there and applying for jobs and you get something that is suitable, doesn't mean it has to be identical to what you last had. You don't have to, you know, nobody's can sit around and wait for the exact same wage, the exact same benefits, the exact same terms and conditions of work. And suitable is judged by, you know, the context of the current economy. You know, workers aren't stupid. They, especially when they've been out of work for a while, they understand they're going to need to make compromises. You know, daily we hear from workers who are so thrilled that they finally found a new job that pays them $20,000 or $30,000 less than they were making before their layoff. But they understand that in the here and now and in this economy, unfortunately, that's the compromise that they have to make. So it's not that suitable provides you wiggle room to stay on benefits longer. It's really that workers and the programs recognize that suitable is defined by the context of the current economic outlook. And it's not that workers are holding out for the perfect job and not taking a penny less than they used to earn. I mean, workers are routinely applying for jobs for which they are grossly overqualified, for which they're going to make a lot less money than they used to. And they're grateful when they even get those vastly inferior jobs because they know that's what the current situation is.
Let us take a call. We have Ann and Eugene on the line. Ann, thanks for waiting. Welcome to The Exchange with Judy Conte.
Thank you. So a book that I read, because I'd heard the author on Jefferson Exchange, is American Nations by Colin Woodward.
Yeah, one of my favorites.
Yeah, and I bought it as gifts for other people. And one of the things that was in there, he was talking about the people who had settled the Deep South as being slave owners from Barbados.
I remember that. They settled in South Carolina and moved west from there, yes.
And his take on their philosophy was that society exists to support the privileged. And it seems like to me, for at least the last 40 years, that is the philosophy that has taken over the Republican Party, and I'd like to hear your comments from your guest about what she thinks about that.
It's almost a slave-owning attitude, you're saying.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, telling people when there's three people for every job that if you let them starve, then they'll find a job. I mean, that's a slave-owning mentality.
All right, let's see what Judy has to say about that. Thanks for the call, Ann. Appreciate it.
Yes, thank you, Anne. Well, it is a mentality that I think is becoming more and more prevalent, sort of the let them eat cake. You know, they get what they deserve. We have this sort of dialogue going on now and this, you know, prevailing message coming from, you know, the right, if you will, that, you know, safety net programs make people weak, and it's bad for the overall economy. And if we just got rid of them, people would stand up on their own. But at the same time, like I've talked about before, we've got wage stagnation like we've never seen before. We have job stagnation that is still fairly staggering. I mean, the amount of jobs that we are creating in any given month over the last year or two isn't terribly robust. It's barely keeping up with the new entrants to the workforce. You know, we see increasing numbers of college graduates working for minimum wage or near minimum wage. When we're telling people, you know, for decades and decades that the college education is the ticket to upward mobility, and yet they come out and they're making $7 or $8, or in the case of Oregon, $9 an hour. And there's this attitude that, well, if that's all they're getting, that's all they're worth. And I just categorically reject that. You know, hardworking people are worthy of earning wages on which they can support themselves and their families. It's just that simple, especially when we see our largest corporations, especially our largest retail providers in this country, making record profits and funneling that to, you know, high-end executive compensation and, you know, huge dividends for stockholders who, of course, make worthwhile investments so that these companies can grow. But the people really making the investments so these companies can grow and thrive are their workers. And it would be really nice if we returned to earlier days where people understood that companies, successful companies and prosperity is built on the backs of the workforce, not on the backs of the shareholder. And unless and until we readjust those priorities and that attitude, I'm afraid we're going to see more and more of the type of dynamics that Anne describes. And that's not good for anybody in this country, not even the uber rich, because it sets up a dynamic in which ultimately our economy will fail.
Judy Conte, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She is the Federal Advocacy Coordinator at NELP, the National Employment Law Project. We are talking about unemployment insurance benefits and minimum wage and other issues affecting American workers more generally. You can join this discussion when we return from a break. Our phone number is 800-838-3760, anywhere you can hear us. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. We'll come back and take your phone calls and talk to Judy Moore in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Judy Conte. She's the Federal Advocacy Coordinator with NELP, the National Employment Law Project. And we're talking in very general terms about the state of things for American workers in the context of Congress letting the long-term unemployment insurance benefits expire just after Christmas. And also Congress wrestling with, and perhaps not too hard, with the concept of raising the federal minimum wage, which currently stands at $7.25. In Oregon at the moment, it's $9.10 as of the first of the year. $8 in California. It'll go to $9 on July 1st. Much to talk about here with Judy Conte. You can join us at 800-838-3760 or 541-552-6782 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. Judy, is the general sense of what happened in Congress or didn't happen in Congress, whoops, we just didn't get to it, or is it a little more deliberate than that?
It's a little bit more deliberate than that. In spite of what many people have said in the press, this was an issue that was brought up again and again and again in the context of the budget negotiations. And one side wanted to get it done and the other side didn't. And at the end of the year, you know, the last week that they were in there, it was all over the media. It was fully debated and argued in the House and in the Senate, and was blocked in the House at the Republican Rules Committee level, and it was blocked in the Senate when it tried to go on the floor by a Republican senator from South Dakota, where the unemployment rate is under 3%. So it wasn't a, oops, we didn't get to it. It was very deliberate that it was not done yet. So that's why advocates across the country have been working fairly nonstop through the last 2.5 weeks over the holidays to make sure that this issue stays alive in the press, in action alerts, making sure people contact their members and let them know how important it is they have to get it done. And you're going to see a whole series of actions across the country on Sunday and Monday and Tuesday at key legislators' offices demanding that Congress take care of this issue when they get back into session.
I think you've hinted at this already in some of the things you've already said, but I know that Paul Krugman and other economists who do have public forums, like their columns, his and the New York Times, have pointed out there's some real dangers to society, not just economically, but just structurally, when you have people unemployed for as long as we've had them unemployed. Can you give us a sketch on that?
Sure, absolutely. Look, I mean, you know, I was talking before about how employers are making mistaken assumptions about people's skills atrophying too soon and too quickly. But when we do see people out of the workforce for 2-3 years, there is no doubt that skills the things that we do as adults to protect ourselves start to dissipate. What is it that adults define themselves by in this world? It is often a spouse or a partner, it is children, but it's their job, it's their work. You know, the American Psychological Association has done some great work showing us the devastating effects that unemployment in general, but long-term unemployment in particular, have on people's psyches. And you know, what it does to them on a very emotional level. So these are all things that make it harder for people to keep going, to get themselves back up and into the workforce after periods of prolonged unemployment. And, you know, we are at a point now where we've got the lowest percentage of labor force participation that we've had in decades. And, again, that's not when our economies thrive. Our economies thrive when people are making good money that, you know, supports them, that supports their families, that they can reinvest in homes or apartments, in, you know, good nutritious food, in clothing, in, you know, gas and transportation to get them back and forth to work and back and forth to school. So, you know, our whole economy really is premised on people earning up to their capacity to support themselves. And when we have low labor force participation, when we have prolonged long-term unemployment, it's really devastating to people on a very personal, emotional level. It often gets families dug into holes from which they cannot crawl out of. But it's bad for our economy as a whole.
Let us take a call from Wolfgang in Sunny Valley. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Judy Conte.
Good morning. It's sunny when it should be raining, but that's a different subject.
Right.
I could sort of write a type of modest proposal, but I'm going to shorten that. First of all, the economy is how you define economy, how anyone defines economy, is sort of fictional. And let me explain to you why I think that. If you underpay people to where they cannot support themselves or a family, you will have two people working for low minimum or below minimum wage. And so you get two for the price of one. And that's good for the 1%, basically. That's the short of it. What I'm trying to say is there is, could there not be and is there not a bottom line that is affirming bad policies, that is affirming starving them out? Because the top looks better.
Well, as I think Judy's explained some of this already, but thanks for that, Wolfgang. But Judy, as you explained, a system that ends up that top-heavy doesn't work, ultimately.
It doesn't. You know, it might work for a decade or two or even three, but the reason why the richest in this country are as rich as they are is because people are buying what they're selling, whether it's consumer goods, whether it's investments, whatever it is. It's because people have money to invest in the goods and the services and the products that are being sold. And if we increasingly concentrate wealth in the hands of fewer and fewer people, we're not going to have that kind of prosperity. You know, the fact of the matter is, we do best as an economy when people have money to spend on the things that they need in life. So, you know, we have a lot of implicit policies, I think, that are ingraining that. You know, a stagnating minimum wage that's been at $7.25 an hour for the last 4 years, and which is, you know, almost $3.50 less when adjusted for inflation than the historical high that it was in the late 1960s.
That was the question, where it would be now if it had been raised all along.
It would be at around $10.70 an hour.
Okay.
So it's a big gap, as you can see. You know, we have all sorts of tax breaks for companies that offshore jobs to, you know, third world and developing countries where people get paid pennies an hour as opposed to keeping them here in the United States and investing in our workforces. You know, those are just, we've got trade policy. We don't only have tax policy that encourages offshoring. We have trade policy that encourages offshoring. So, you know, the jobs that built the middle class and had us thriving in the 50s and 60s and even the 70s, things like, you know, manufacturing and auto workers, we've sent all those things far, far away to other countries. And we don't have them here. And it's no wonder that we are suffering so badly. I mean, when we've taken all of these actions, there were advocates, there were economists, there were policymakers that foretold everything to exactly what has happened today. So unfortunately, none of this should come as a surprise. But yet we've got fairly simple solutions we could be taking in order to alleviate some of these problems, but we don't seem to have the political will to do it.
All right. A little more than 5 minutes left here on the exchange, and about three calls to take, starting with Daryl in Mount Shasta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Judy Conte.
Hello. I almost feel as though I should apologize for being morbid, but my question is I'm wondering if there's anybody keeping track with people's employment benefits being cut off and no work available, no jobs available, whether or not anybody's keeping track of the suicide rate. This is inspired by the social Darwinism that was brought up by a previous caller. My other question would be, if you have time, is if she's familiar with Chris Matthews' Twilight of the Meritocracy, which kind of says, you know, if people succeed, they deserve it.
All right.
Okay, I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Daryl.
You know, like I said earlier, the American Psychological Association is doing some really exceptional work on what long-term unemployment is doing to people, including, you know, people trying to or succeeding in taking their own lives. I can't be sure of how well people are keeping track of those statistics because in a lot of cases it might be hard to isolate and who knows how much is reported. But I would check, you know, APA.org to see probably the best collection of statistics and information that's out there. You know, in terms of if, you know, people succeed, they must deserve it, there is truth to that. But the corollary that that implies is that if people don't succeed, they didn't deserve it. And all you have to do is look around your communities to see how untrue that is, to see people who are educated, who have great work ethics, who, you know, who have built 20, 30-year careers, who have never been out of work and never been unable to care for themselves, who all of a sudden have been victims of the recession and the recovery and have lost everything. You know, they've lost their homes. They've lost their retirement savings. They can't get new jobs. They're living on subsistence level unemployment benefits or other safety net programs. And it's not because they don't deserve to succeed. It's because our economy has failed them. So, yes, it's all well and good that people succeed on their own merit, but we need to create a country and economy where everybody who works hard can succeed. And we don't have that right now. It's just that simple.
Paul in Grants Pass, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Judy Conte.
Oh, Judy, we need to spend several hours talking. First of all, the United States is probably the cleanest and best candidate for a classic Marxist revolution that's ever existed in the world. Secondly, as a comment for unemployment insurance, it's a travesty that it was not extended. Essentially, what you've done at best is moved 1.5 million people into the underground economy where they are trying to survive and not commit and not contributing to probably our economy in the same way that they possibly can. And finally, probably you've criminalized the behavior of 1.5 million people in the doing of this, at least. So that's my comment on unemployment. On the issue of raising the minimum wage, no society has survived without an underclass. It is slavery. In my opinion, and I think the idea of creating more living wage jobs is a superb and lofty goal. I don't know if legislating living wage jobs will do the job, and I'll leave it there because I know we're short on time.
All right, thank you, Paul.
I would just quickly comment that, you know, legislating living wage jobs won't fix all of the problem, and we can't do that in its entirety, but raising the minimum wage, making sure that jobs that are either government jobs or government contracting jobs pay living wages are two very concrete steps that can go a long way into raising people out of poverty, closing income gaps, and using it as an upward pressure on wages as a whole.
Joe in Dillard, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Judy Conte.
Yes, my only comment is I'd like to alert people to something I found out by researching my property taxes, and that is the National Judicial College in Reno, Nevada, and the Appraisal Institute. And my research tells me that the National Judicial College is preparing all the judges, not just in the United States but in the world, to be prepared for great changes in our society, and they're adjusting the legal system for that. Also, the Appraisal Institute...
All right, stop. What does this have to do with unemployment benefits or the minimum wage?
Well, it has to do with the general governorship of our state. Our governor appointed all of these tax court judges, and every one of them goes to the Appraisal Institute, and all of them go to the National College, National Judicial College.
Okay, another show, another day, Joe. Thank you for that. Let's return to the topics that we actually did have on the table already, Judy. It's been pointed out by some commentators that the reason that there's agitation for a higher minimum wage, for example, for fast food workers, is because those are now jobs that heads of families are seeking rather than kids in high school.
Right. You know, 88% of those earning minimum wage or near minimum wage are over the age of 20, and the largest percentage of parents are earning at or near minimum wage than at any other time in our history since the Great Depression. You know, when you look at the job growth in this country, it is overwhelmingly low-wage hourly jobs, those making less than $10 an hour. So if that is how our economy is growing, if that is increasingly how adults and people with education, not just people who didn't make it through high school or only have a high school diploma for whatever reason. You know, there are people with all sorts of levels of college education that are making these kind of wages. If that's the way our economy is going, we have to do something to make those jobs better. And when you have companies like Walmart and McDonald's making money hand over fist, paying generous dividends, making, you know, executive compensation that would turn my hair pink upon hearing it. Those are companies that can afford to pay their workers more money and can afford to help the communities and the economies that they prosper in. You know, Walmart is notorious for handing out applications for public benefits at its employee orientations because they know they aren't paying people enough money to live in the communities where they work. So, you know, instead of handing out applications for public benefits, they should look inward and invest in their people and adopt the Henry Ford model. And his philosophy was he was going to pay his workers enough money so that they could afford to buy the cars that he manufactured. And look what a company he built. And look how it thrived and the communities that he worked in thrived. That's the way that we build an economy that works for everyone.
As expected, a very lively discussion on unemployment benefits and the minimum wage with Judy Conte, who's with NELP, the National Employment Law Project, as Federal Advocacy Coordinator. Thanks so much for joining us, Judy.
Thanks for inviting me. Happy New Year to you and all your listeners.
Happy New Year. Monday on the Jefferson Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk once again about the shooting of barred owls. We'll get the Fish and Wildlife Service perspective. We'll talk about a public records case at Oregon State University that got a worker in hot water there. And then at 9 o'clock, we'll talk to the author of the book Smarter, which asks the question, can you actually boost your IQ higher than what it's been reported at so far? That's all Monday on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer is Charlotte Duren. She's also at the controls today. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.